The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 23rd of June 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up, the Taliban appeals for international help following a devastating earthquake in Afghanistan. We will have the latest. Also ahead, we'll be finding out why Belgium has returned a golden tooth, which once belonged to a Congolese independence leader. Plus, we'll have a roundup of news from the world of fashion. And then Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here with some more of his favorite summer tunes. What have you got for us this time, Fernando?
Hello, Markus. For today's global countdown, it's summer on wheels and plenty of pumped up beats.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. The Taliban in Afghanistan have appealed for international support following a devastating earthquake in the country. More than 1,000 people are known to have been killed and many more have been injured. Rescue efforts have been hampered by rain and lack of resources. Lynn O'Donnell is a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine and former AP and AFP bureau chief in Afghanistan. Welcome to the program. Lynn, first of all, how difficult do international sanctions make getting aid to Afghanistan?
Oh, hi, Markus. I don't think they've made it very difficult at all to get aid to Afghanistan. What makes it difficult to get aid to people who need it are the Taliban. The Taliban are, as you know, former insurgents. They won a 20-year war that was led by the United States to support a democratic republic that collapsed under the weight of its own under the weight of its own corruption, but also the support that it had from the Western community for 20 years evaporated. And so the Taliban took over without any capacity and hundreds of thousands of middle-class, educated, professional people left. Aid continued to pour in. The Americans have spent more than $2 billion so far. Most of it goes through the United Nations agencies. They take 30% off the top just immediately to cover salaries and other overheads. And the rest is funneled through on-the-ground partnerships with non-government organizations that can only operate with the approval of the Taliban. And so when I've been looking into this over the last couple of weeks, people have been telling me that the Taliban then takes another 25 to 75% of the aid and money that comes in through the United Nations system. So it's the Taliban that is hampering the aid getting to people who need it, and the situation with the earthquake doesn't seem to be very different at all.
How hopeless is the situation on the ground at the moment? How much do we know?
Well, we only know the figures that the Taliban are telling us, and I suspect that they will use this as an opportunity to gain legitimacy. I'm already seeing the BBC showing photographs saying that the source is the Afghanistan government. There isn't a government. They don't have legitimacy or diplomatic recognition. What they are is an incompetent administration that has no capacity. So without doctors, without clinics, without health professionals, disaster relief professionals, it's very, very difficult to know what the real situation is on the ground and what the real figures are. I'm hearing from people who are on the ground saying that the number of people dead and injured could be much, much higher, possibly 3,000 people dead. But as I said, it's just impossible to know because the Taliban do not have the capacity and they're not listening to those who they sacked who do have the capacity.
Now, what the hardline Islamist leadership in Afghanistan has said is that the sanctions imposed by Western countries mean it is handicapped in its ability to deal with the disaster that took place on Wednesday. Is that simply blame game?
Well, you know, it's always easy to blame somebody else for the problems that you create for yourself. The fact is that there is a huge problem with the financial system. The United States and the United Nations implemented sanctions on the financial sector immediately the Taliban took control last August. And that means that ordinary people cannot access their own cash in their own bank accounts. But aside from that, the United Nations uses charter flights to send in $32 million in cash every week that is deposited in the central bank. Now, when the small NGO, when the United Nations sends money and aid to the localized non-government organizations, it makes them sign a contract saying none of this will go to the Taliban or any of its constituents. But people on the ground tell me that it doesn't make any difference. The Taliban demand lists of who are going to be the recipients. They change and divert the recipients and basically make sure that their own supporters and their own soldiers are getting money and food and medicines that are meant to be distributed nationwide.
Do you think, is there any chance that this devastating situation in the country at the moment could threaten the Taliban's leadership? Do you think people are asking why the Taliban is not doing more to help them?
I think that that there will be a growing tide of dissatisfaction with the Taliban's lack of ability to govern. There's no rule of law. There's no security. There's no judiciary. You have an internal problem where the leadership, which is extremely obscurantist, if you like, in its ideological viewpoint, is holding the rest of the country to hostage, really. They don't believe in science. They don't believe in relationships with the outside. They only believe in a very dogmatic view of religion, and it's extremely difficult to argue with that. Now, people who are in the country tell me that, okay, we can put up with the Taliban keeping our women at home, out of work, and our girls banned from schools. But when it comes to hunger, once they get to the point of real starvation, real deprivation, that's when anger will rise. And so the Taliban really have to get their act together and start acting like a government if they aren't going to face a revolt on the ground from the people that they claim to be governing.
That was the Afghanistan specialist Lynn O'Donnell. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's almost 12:08 here in London. Now here is Monaco's Carlo Torrebello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Ukraine is set to be approved as an EU candidate at a summit in Brussels. Ukraine applied for membership of the bloc just days after the Russian invasion in February. However, officials in Kyiv have conceded that integration is only likely once the war has ended. Parties from left and right of French politics have rejected President Emmanuel Macron's pleas for help to overcome a hung parliament following inconclusive legislative elections. Macron's rivals have said he must clarify the compromises he is prepared to make to win their backing. And Europe's biggest Indian film festival gets underway today with a programme dedicated to showcasing films from the subcontinent and its diaspora. The London Indian Film Festival will screen films of all genres and styles in cities around the UK. You can find out more about it at monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Carlotta. Now, Belgium has returned a golden tooth belonging to the murdered Congolese independence hero Patrice Lumumba to members of his family. Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Müller reports.
The restitution to their original owners of historical artefacts acquired in dubious circumstances has been a recurring theme of recent years, and probably quite rightly. Indeed, the Foreign Desk did a whole thing on this in episode 381 last April, and you can hasten to that just as soon as you finished absorbing the next few minutes of this, which, we absolutely promise, gets entrancingly weird. Because joining more traditional cultural objects, such as statues, jewellery, and the mummified heads of ancestors returning whence they came, is a tooth. Specifically, a gold-crowned tooth, the only mortal remains of Patrice Lumumba, Prime Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo for a few months in 1960. In a ceremony earlier this week at the Egmont Palace in Brussels, hosted by Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo, Lumumba's tooth was formally returned by Belgium to Lumumba's family. Offering apologies on behalf of Belgium's government, De Croo noted that it isn't normal that Belgians held on to the remains of one of the founding fathers of the Congolese nation for six decades. It is casting no aspersions on De Croo's sincerity to note that, depressingly, in the broader sweep of Belgium's interactions with Congo, the crass souveniring of Lumumba's tooth is, or was at the time, absolutely and wretchedly normal. Many countries have a what-if story, a wistfully contemplated parallel universe in which maybe if one bad thing never happened, then maybe a lot of subsequent and consequent bad things wouldn't have happened either. Patrice Lumumba is the Democratic Republic of Congo's variant of this imaginary nostalgia. The basics of Lumumba's brief but extraordinary life are these. In the late 1950s, he was among the founders of the Mouvement National Congolais. The MNC was a party dedicated to securing independence for what was then still the Belgian Congo, the colony which had succeeded the Congo Free State, infamously the private property of Belgium's King Leopold II, who had presided over his fiefdom with a dismal mix of brutality and indifference. In May 1960, the new nation of the Republic of Congo held its first democratic election. It was won by Lumumba's faction of the MNC, and he was duly sworn in as the new country's first prime minister on June 24, 1960. He was 34.
Je vous salue au nom du gouvernement congolais. À vous tous, mes amis, qui avez lutté sans relâche à nos côtés. Je vous demande de faire.
Lumumba was a young man with big ideas which caused nerves to jangle in various foreign capitals. Given that Lumumba's big ideas were mostly to do with maybe deploying his country's colossal mineral riches to the benefit of his country's mostly poor people, they shouldn't have been controversial. But it was perceived that Lumumba was, if not necessarily sympathetic to the Soviet Union, perfectly willing to accept help from Moscow, whether offered in good faith or not. Lumumba could probably have played his hand more tactfully, but he didn't deserve what happened. Military mutinies and secessionist revolts were fomented. Belgium did not much bother to conceal its involvement in these, and nor did the United States, who feared that Lumumba was some Congolese Castro and had rejected his requests for investment and assistance.
They caught him on his way to Stanleyville and flew him back. Patrice Lumumba securely wrote.
On September 5th, 1960, Lumumba was sacked by President Joseph Kasavubu, after which Lumumba tried to sack Kasavubu. Lumumba's Army Chief of Staff, Colonel Joseph Désiré Mobutu, threw a coup d'état in Kasavubu's favour. Lumumba was arrested, detained, beaten, tortured, and on or around January 17, 1961, executed by firing squad.
His recapture was quite a triumph for Colonel Mobutu, who now saw his enemy arise. Lumumba's bonds are tightened. They were taking no chances. And his wife and child watch his humiliation. The whole affair, of course, serves to underline once again the conditions prevailing in the Congo. It's not enough to arrest a man. He must apparently be beaten up as well. Then put him on trial later, no doubt.
His body, along with those of two associates, Maurice Mpolo and Joseph Okito, was dismembered and dissolved in acid, the bones ground to powder. A Belgian gendarme, Gerard Soete, pocketed at least one of Lumumba's teeth. Colonel Mobutu would become Mobutu Sese Seko, a vicious, ridiculous, and palpably insane tyrant who would plunder and terrorize Congo, or as he renamed it, Zaire, until 1997. Mobutu's legacies include the largely disused runway he installed to enable Concorde to perform such vital state functions as flying his birthday cakes from Paris. The return of Lumumba's tooth to what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo is the latest in a long series of hesitant steps Belgium has taken towards rapprochement with its former colony. In 2002, Belgium apologized for its role in Lumumba's murder. In 2018, a square was named after Lumumba in Brussels. Earlier this month, King Philippe of Belgium visited the DRC and pulled, regarding Belgium's historical behaviour in the vicinity, the always delicate, deepest regrets short of actually apologising manoeuvre.
On the occasion of my first trip to Congo, here, I reaffirm my deepest regrets for these wounds of the past.
It is probably safe to take a lot of Belgium's outreach at face value. Like many former imperial powers, it is still trying to figure out what debts its history might owe the present. But Belgium does still have more base interests in DRC. The oldest continually functioning private company in the country is the engineering giant Forest Group, established in 1922. And Belgium, like everyone else, needs the DRC's vast and undertapped reserves of coltan, lithium and cobalt, among other mineral treasures. Patrice Lumumba's tooth will be flown to Kinshasa and interred at a memorial site. 3 days of mourning will be observed in Lumumba's honour later this month, around the 62nd anniversary of the independence of the Democratic Republic of Congo, a country which might, had Lumumba been allowed to live, have enjoyed 62 better years than the 62 it has endured.
Nous ne pouvons que formuler ce vœu.
We can only wish that wherever you are,
ce vœu que tu puisses faire, de là où tu es,
you can be proud of your children,
de là où tu te trouves, être fier de tes enfants,
your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren,
et de tes arrière-petits-enfants. Père, à présent,
Father, welcome back to the country.
Au pays.
For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Miller.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Andrew. You are with Monocle 24. You are with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Let's now continue with the latest business news with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Thanks for joining us, as always, Ewan. First of all, Germany is now moving to the next stage of its gas risk level. What does that mean in practice?
Marcus, yeah, Germany's warning that Russia's move to slash Europe's natural gas supplies is risking sparking a collapse in energy markets, drawing rather alarmingly a parallel with the role of Lehman Brothers in triggering the financial crisis in 2008. Now, Europe's biggest economy has raised its gas risk level to its second highest phase, called rather worryingly the alarm phase. For months, of course, Russian President Vladimir Putin has been gradually reducing supplies in apparent retaliation for the sanctions levied over the war in Ukraine. And that gas standoff has escalated last week after steep cuts to the main gas link to Germany. And that's putting supplies for winter at risk, because they're normally built up over the summer. Germany relies on Russia for more than a third of its natural gas supplies and moves to cut gas deliveries through the Nord Stream pipeline. This is Nord Stream 1, of course, not the new one, make it all but impossible to secure sufficient gas reserves for the winter without additional measures. That's what the German economy minister says. Now, in practice, the heightened alert level means a tighter monitoring of the market by Germany, and some coal-fired power plants are going to be reactivated in time for winter. It also is, according to Germany, a signal for the rest of Europe to cut its energy consumption as we move towards winter. The alert stage also gives the German government the option of enacting legislation to allow energy companies to pass on cost increases to homes and businesses. The worry is, of course, is they have to stomach the losses that some of these companies could go under, and that is where the contagion risk comes. But for now, Germany says that they're not going to move those price adjustments just yet. They're going to see how the market reacts.
And then, Ewan, in other news, we're seeing talk of a global downturn feeding through into commodity prices. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, Marcus, this is something of a good news story for you. Just to sum up the economic picture in about 20 seconds, the world has an inflation problem, not least because of those soaring energy costs. And in response, global central banks are rapidly raising interest rates. And that is slowing economies and leading to talk of a possible recession. Well, so far, so gloomy. But the good news is that all that talk of a downturn is seeing a commodities sell-off. Now, this is not good news if you're buying commodities, but it is good news for the rest of the economy. Copper extending its slump to a 16-month low. Copper is a classic cyclical commodity, very important when the economy is growing. A lot of copper is used in the manufacture of all sorts of things, and copper prices have really been going down. And the world's most important commodity, that is selling off as well. Oil dropping again today. West Texas Intermediate sinking towards $104 a barrel. Closed at a six-week low yesterday. Just a few sessions ago, we were above $120 a barrel. So crude oil has been tumbling on those fears that the global economy is slowing. And of course, all that means that those prices should start to feed through into inflation itself, as of course crude oil is important for all sorts of things, not just manufacturing, but also transport, as we all get around, and the transport of goods to markets. So that is really important for inflation. So a little bit of good news on the inflation story. So perhaps that will start to feed through to the wider economy.
Let's hope so. Ewan, thanks for this update. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, and you are listening to The Briefing. We are going to get a roundup from Milan Men's Fashion Week now. Monaco's fashion editor Natalie Theodosias spent the week there. Good afternoon to you, Natalie. It sounds like these kind of events are back with full force. Is that the impression you got in Milan as well?
Hi, Marcus. And absolutely, yes. I think fashion brands are ready to get back into action. And that was really the impression of the week, starting with Pitti and then spending 4 days in Milan. Everyone was back on the catwalk, including all the big brands that had taken a little bit of a break over the last 2 years, from Prada to Armani to Fendi, Gucci, Canali. Everyone was hosting runway shows and hosting also for the first time in over 3 years, international press, buyers, and a lot of celebrities were in town and attending these shows, and their brand ambassadors as well.
Are brands trying any new things now in 2022, or is everything still very much focused around catwalk shows?
I think when we were in lockdown during the pandemic, everyone said that they were going to try and experiment with new formats, and they tried videos, which didn't work as well. So there was a lot of appetite to return to the catwalk and a lot of excitement around that. So we were all really excited to see the Prada show, for example. They transformed their venue at the Fondazione Prada into this house with checkered curtains and cardboard boxes, almost like a doll's house. But it was really exciting to also see some brands get a bit more creative and experiment with new formats. For example, Gucci took over a vintage, a famous vintage store in Milan called Cavalli and Estri, and presented its new collection there. And Armani, after its Emporio Armani show, also invited guests to an exhibition at its fashion museum in Milan and showcased the work of 10 really interesting international photographers.
Do you think these new formats worked, considering how much you've been working with fashion? Is this something we need at the moment?
I think we definitely need a mix of both. And it's also interesting to see brands thinking beyond just the clothing and of course, the catwalk. For example, Armani working with photographers who are not necessarily from the fashion world and bringing in a new perspective. Or in the case of Gucci, except from the partnership with the vintage store, they also did a collaboration with the head mixologist at the Connaught and created a pre-mixed cocktail for the summer. So yes, brands are trying to touch every aspect of luxury now, not just clothing, which is really interesting, and it provides a better experience for the customer as well.
Well, Natalie, you are on your way to Paris today. Let's talk about that shortly. But before that, one more question now, after you've been in Italy. You mentioned some pretty well-known family-run brands already, and it sounds like there's been some evolution in some of these companies with some family members stepping down from top positions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this season there was a lot of new chapters being started and some closing at Missoni, which is one of Italy's best-known family-run businesses. There is a new creative director who is taking over Angela Missoni. This is the first time someone who is not from the family is designing the clothing, and he presented a small menswear collection as his debut and spoke a lot about spending time with the family, looking at their archives, though, and respecting that heritage and the codes of the brand. And similarly, at Etro, Keen Etro, showed his very last collection. He was very emotional talking about it backstage, but he also said that it's time for disruption and he's ready to just take a step back and hand in the reins to this young Italian designer, Marco De Vincenzo, who they hired to come in and take the position of creative director. So it's interesting to see that these businesses that were purely family run are now opening up to young talent, and dynamics will shake up a little bit. What their clothes look like might change in the next few seasons as well.
So it's certainly a very interesting time for those brands. But now, Natalie, let's briefly talk about Paris Men's Fashion Week, which is starting now. What do you expect from that event?
Paris, I think, will be really exciting as well. I'm actually just on my way to the Eurostar to catch a train there. And starting tonight, Dries Van Noten, the great Belgian designer, is going to make his return to the catwalk after exactly 3 years. So that's very much anticipated. I think big brands from the LVMH stable, which rules Paris fashion, will be there and hosting really big, exciting shows like Dior and Louis Vuitton. There's a lot of retail openings as well because physical retail is returning. For example, the Scandinavian brand Acne will be inaugurating a big new flagship in on Rue Saint-Honoré. And something else that fashion insiders are quite excited about is a secret show by Celine, another LVMH brand, which is happening really late at night on a Sunday, and details are all under wraps. Again, Celine has been away from the spotlight, just releasing images of its collections for 3 years. So it will be exciting to see what they do now that they are back.
Now, finally, Natalie, basing on what you've seen in Milan and what you expect from Paris, what do you think I will be wearing in a few months' time, and maybe our producer, Rhys James, as well?
Suits, I think. That's what everyone has been talking about in Milan. I can tell you what Stefano Canali told me from the great sartorial company, that tailoring is back in fashion, it's here to stay, that people are really keen to get rid of all their lockdown wardrobes and all those tracksuits and just wear suits. But the good news is that the suits are usually done in really soft fabrics and they're looser, so you and Rhys can be really comfortable, Marcus, and still look stylish.
Looking forward to getting them soon. Bring something back from Paris, will you?
I will.
That was Monocle's fashion editor, Natalie Theodosi. And you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally on today's programme, it's time for Fernando Augusto Pacheco's Global Countdown. And we are continuing with the summer theme, I've been told, Fernando. Tell us more.
It's our second part of the summer soundtrack. And basically, it's connected to our new issue, which is out now. It's a quality of life special. And I compiled a list of 100 songs for the summer, divided in 5 different moods. So I'll play one song for each mood for you, Marcus.
So we're not actually counting down to anything this time around, are we? These songs are not in a specific order.
No, they were all chosen by me. So it's basically my very own countdown, but I hope you like it. I think you were a big part of it, I have to say, but we discussed this a little bit later. The first mood, Marcus, is Road Trip. Mm-hmm. And you can see even in the title for that song. Let's have a listen and then we speak a little bit more about this. It's the wonderful and iconic Cher with Hell on Wheels.
What kind of road trips do you have planned for this summer, Fernando?
Everywhere. Well, I'm heading to Mexico very soon, so perhaps I'll be listening to this. And you know, in the video, Marcus, it's basically Cher roller skating in a road full of trucks. And she's there. It's iconic. It's from 1979. Quite disco, but with some rock touches to it as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, she can't go wrong, I have to say. I have nothing bad to say about Cher.
I can see from your face that you did really enjoy that. I wonder, what do you think about the next track? Obviously, you like it because you have picked it.
Yes. This is Apéro time. So it's you know, it's something before dinner. A little bit gentle, but still funky. So you can still dance to it. And this one is a kind of a remix of a very old track from Japan by Maria Takuchi called Count What You Have Now, but it's being remixed by Vantage, which I believe it's a French DJ. Let's have a listen.
I would probably have to have quite a few drinks during my apéro time if I was listening to this track.
I mean, it's wonderful. Well, why a few drinks? You didn't like it? It's great. It's a bit J-funk. And Vantage is great. I think he loves Japanese music and he kind of remixes all of those classics as well.
I think these songs are in funny order because doesn't afternoon sunbathing happen before apéro time?
It's summer, we're all a bit drunk, so the order can be, it's all a bit mixed up. But yeah, our next mood is afternoon sunbathing. So it's something very gentle, so you can feel the rays of light in your body. And this track, I have to say, Marcus, I actually like ambient music. I don't think you knew this about me.
No, something new.
I love it. I feel at peace and I do listen to this quite a lot. You can have a drink as well when your afternoon sunbathing. Let's have a listen. They are from Italy. The band is called Aura Safari and the song is called Dreams of Music.
So I'm trying to imagine your holiday plans. You've had half a dozen of Aperol spritzes and then you're listening to this track when you're sunbathing.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And Aura Safari, that's the whole vibe of their music. So you're transported to kind of a desert island and listening to dreams of music. I think it's pretty cool.
I wonder where you're being transported when you listen to the next track that actually happens to be from Finland. And I have to say that this artist is from my hometown of Siilinjärvi originally.
And Marcus, I was telling that I picked the 100 tracks. That's kind of a lie. To be honest, we had some help from the Monocle staff, and you are the one who suggested this track, and I completely agree with you. It's perfect for our next mood, which is Euro Dance Floor. He is indeed from your hometown, Isaac Sene. Can you pronounce the name of the song before we have a listen?
Oh, you're trying to escape your responsibility.
Yes.
This is Kuuma Jäbä.
It's sexy.
Oh, we could have played it longer.
Yes, it's sexy. It's great. And is it true, Marcus, that he tried actually to be the Finnish entry for Eurovision?
He was trying, but I don't think the Finnish... Finnish people are a bit conservative when it comes to Eurovision. They always go for the artists they know already. So this year round, we sent Rasmus to represent us.
I need to go for a proper sit down with the Finnish people because this could do very well at Eurovision. Well, it's not on Eurovision, but it's in our summary list, right? Which is good enough.
I wonder. I'm quite sure the next track is one of your favorites, actually, because it happens to be from Brazil, I understand. And the theme is Brazilian sunset.
Brazilian sunset. And you can interpret that the whatever you want. So basically, it's late night, it's a bit romantic, it's a bit fun. And this is indeed a classic artist from Brazil. His name is Pepeu Gomes. The song is called Sexy Iemanjá.
What is Iemanjá?
Iemanjá, she is the Brazilian goddess of seas. To be honest, I say Brazilian, but a lot of people in Cuba and Nigeria also have Iemanjá as a goddess. So she, there's even a festival in Brazil where you kind of give flowers to Iemanjá. When you go to the sea and then you just drop like a flower in the ocean for her. And apparently, you know, this song's about the sexy Iemanjá, sexy goddess. Shall we have a listen, Marcus?
Sure. Brazilian, when you are in Brazil, in your home country, how much do you celebrate Iemanjá over there?
I mean, I like Iemanjá. You know what I like actually about Brazil and this song? All religions in Brazil, sometimes there's a mix and match. So it doesn't matter if you're a Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, everybody kind of likes Iemanjá and give flowers to her. It doesn't matter your religion. And it's playful. I quite like it.
So when you're in Sao Paulo, where do you take those flowers to sexy Iemanjá?
We don't have actually an ocean, so you have to go to the beach, which, to be honest, the nearest one is an hour away. So, you know, on the 2nd of February, you can go there. That's the date you celebrate her.
Exactly. Thanks for this countdown. That was Monaco's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James. Our researcher was Isabel Rose. And our studio manager was Chris Ablakwa. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time, but the Monocle Daily team will be here with a roundup of the day's main news stories at 1800 London time. That's at 10 a.m. in San Francisco. I am Marcus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.